Hi
Hey,
there.
how's it
Today I'm
going?
here with Chris Correa. He is a software developer from Atlanta, and he's working as at This Dot Labs, but he's also the organizer, co-organizer of DevOps Day Atlanta. Chris, very happy to have you here on the podcast, and we are going to talk about DevOps and developer productivity and all of that stuff. I'm really excited about that. How's it going?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So, for those of us who don't know you yet, could you give us a brief introduction on yourself and what you're doing?
Sure. My background is in socio-technical platform engineering. So for the past 10 years, I've been aligning DevOps and site reliability engineering practices across value streams, and also doing Wordly mapping, which is a flavor of dependency chain mapping. And sort of combining those two, it drifts into complexity science. So it's
Wow.
how we go about enabling platforms is making sure the dependencies are met. That emergent complexity from the social side of socio-technical systems, which are really human-centered, really focused on the people. Both the customers and folks internal, like developers and testers and security, everybody.
That's a lot of complicated words and buzzwords. Help me unpack that a bit. So you're looking at the personal side of things, like at the developer as a person, and you help them with what actually?
It's what we're tracking, making sure we've got systems that are easy to onboard into, well documented, easy to get work done. There's a level of resilience and graceful degradation, which help with things like on-call rotation and not waking up folks in the middle of the night. That's really at the heart of DevOps. That being earlier in the process, when projects are starting off, but we don't want to throw work over the wall from development to operations for them to ship it while devs are at, drinking champagne at a release party. So that's the first wall of division is between development and operations. But it expands outside the org and eventually hits your customers if you're not mindful of it.
Yeah. I mean, we all have been in the place where we got onboarded to a new project and then it took days and days and days just to write the first line of code before everything runs. So this is certainly the core to the problem that you're solving, right?
Absolutely. How long does it take you to get a laptop and access when you first onboard to a project? It's been months for me before.
Oh yeah, totally.
And then the other side of it, somehow open source software gets built and developed, and there's not like a management layer. It's, largely volunteer driven. So that's a large part of platform engineering, I think. Is how do you get that open source mentality into corporations, companies, and other organizations where they can operate like that internally? Sounds more obvious than it is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because like in the best worlds of all, we would just go check out the repo, maybe hit some, maybe ideally one button, and then we are ready to go, write our first line of code, create our pull request, and we are done, right? This is, at least to my experience, not what happens in the real world.
No, it can be a lot bumpier. There's a lot of institutional knowledge where you sort of have to, earn your seat at the table by digging through the code base and pairing with new coworkers to figure out all the ins and outs. That's why I, onboarding to a new project, and I think one of the easiest spots to jump in for open source contribution is just as you're trying to use the project, even not even develop on it, but as you're onboarding that, just updating the docs as you go, taking notes of stuff that didn't make sense and where it
Make
could
it
be
better.
clearer. It's an
Yeah.
easy spot to pitch in on projects.
So, and I think the reason for that is like software is becoming more complex over time, apparently. So like you have a lot more dependencies, you have distributed systems and stuff like that. So how does like platform engineering in general like tackle that problem? I mean, you can't get rid of dependencies, you can manage them better. You can't get rid of complexity, you can just manage them better. So what are like the strategies or tactics to manage that?
That's absolutely right. You cannot remove complexity from a system. You can abstract it. It really gets into the second law of thermodynamics if you dig into it deep enough, where it's just like there's friction and you need a little friction. Without some friction, you don't have any traction. Nothing goes anywhere. So the way we address that through platform engineering, you know, we talked about development and operations being silos. And a wall between them, you know, they're divided and you want to knock that wall down. And it's easy when you're in a startup to that you can fit all the employees in a conference room at the same time and have one big group conversation. But as your company grows, that doesn't work. You eventually get big enough, right, where you're going to have some siloing as out of necessity. It's just you can't fit everybody in the same room at the same time. So yeah. At that point, you want them loosely coupled and permeable, where they can connect as they need to and take space when they need to. And if you're an outsider that wants to know more, you know, let's say you're a Python developer in an organization, you want to learn more about how infrastructure gets built and how your application gets shipped, you're not necessarily required to know that. You don't have to know that to get code into production. You just have to submit a pull request to GitHub or whatever, and it gets merged and pushed out. But if you want to know, you can go pull that thread and find out as much as you want. And that's really where platform folks get excited. We like it when things are abstracted and developers can just sort of like meet us at a pull request and not worry about it. But it's really awesome when they get curious and want to know how it works, because then we've got we can have someone with some platform expertise embedded at a team level, and that helps everyone improve. That helps everyone get better.
Yeah, I think the whole DevOps terminology in and of itself comes from the idea of tearing down the wall between development and operations, right? So does that really happen in practice? Because my impression is we have development, we have operations, and now we have a third thing, that are DevOps engineers. So is that really the case, or what's your take on that?
So I'll say recently, it's been in the past few years, platform engineering got to be popular. DevOps was an improvement over Agile, where we got better at planning. Then it's like, okay, how do we actually get this built and released? And through automation and, you know, culture and communication change, it got improved. But, you know, you're on a new project. You're going to need some DevOps practices. So you're going to be using source control. You're going to want infrastructure as code to spin up your infra. Maybe you're doing test-driven development, so you're going to need testing framework. There's a dependency chain off of that. And you can get something maybe working on your local environment, your laptop. And then you want to get that into a test environment, which, you know, you could call that development or smoke test or non-prod, you know, whatever you want to label it. But eventually, if all things go well, that's going to get some production traffic. You're going to have some real users on the site or in your app using the code you wrote. That's ultimately the goal. So at that point, those lean practices that DevOps grew out of, if you read the Phoenix Project, it was based on the goal, gets into deming and lean manufacturing stuff. As you get into production, you start to move more into safety science and human factors, which is where site reliability engineering comes in, that you've got users in production. And now production stability is a priority over getting changes into prod. So they start off with DevOps, reducing that friction to production. And then at some point, you're less worried about IAC, your environment environments are spun up, they're reproducible. Now we're wondering about, you know, canary releases and what like our web perf is and how many nines of availability we're sustaining. You end up with different questions and different social practices around that.
I mean, there are a lot of like moving parts that eventually come together. Like you have to have a CI, you have to have a CD, you have to have a test pipeline, you have to have environment that you can push test releases or staging releases to. You have to care about like observability, tracing, logging, all that stuff. So this is a lot of confusing topics. And that doesn't even include the technology behind it. It's just like the conceptual way of thinking on that. So how do you even get started with
it? Start with a map. I'm big on the mapping.
A brain dump or something, or a mind map?
No map is perfect. Some maps are useful. So the point of a map is to facilitate a conversation. And that's really what you're trying to do, even if it's easier to map with somebody else starting off than by yourself. Once you get experience, it's easier to push a map around on your own. But there's, you know, I would argue a Kanban board is a map because you can't just move the cards on a Kanban board around without changing the meaning. It's anchored. You've got your swim lanes, you've got your columns. So you see a lot of neat diagrams, and mind maps often fall into diagrams where some kind of graph network thing, and if you spin it around, it doesn't change the meaning at all. So it might be a useful diagram, technically not a map.
Okay, got it.
So I like value stream maps because they provide horizontal flow, and a Kanban board does that in a similar fashion. You've got horizontal flow, and then Wordly maps are for the dependencies on your process steps. So like you brought up testing, like what dependencies do we need to run tests successfully? And where are we sourcing those from? Are we going to build all that tooling internally? Are we going to use what comes like with the standard library for the software language you're coding in? Or are we going to use some third-party SaaS tool or AI for that matter? We've got more options on the table now.
Is that basically what you're doing in your job, like enabling this kind of conversation and trying to find the right tools to facilitate that conversation? Is it like on a management level, or is your work also like, let's say, on an implementation level where you say, okay, for these things we use that technology and stuff like that? So how does that relate to each other?
It varies. I'm always mapping. It is, you know, the methodology I've got. I'm always pulling things onto a map to take into consideration where our point of constraint is, how we can deliver value, you know, what dependencies aren't being met that might be preventing us from doing that. Sometimes that's front-loaded architecturally, but I'm always very tactile. I'm always very hands-on. Fingers on keyboard. So it's sometimes I'm writing code. Sometimes it's infrastructure and containers and Kubernetes. Sometimes it is more diagramming and documentation. Just, you know, depends on where the team I'm working with is at and what's going to be most helpful.
Okay. So if you were to like build the technological foundation for like a company relying on those principles from scratch, what would be the stack that you're using? You mentioned Kubernetes. Maybe there's also like something like Backplane or something. What are the tools of the trade here that you would recommend for someone starting out?
So in true consultant fashion, I'm going to say it depends.
of course.
Trap I see a lot of startups get caught in is building for problems they don't have yet. So I'm very much of the line proof of concept, minimum viable products, and then that gets into production and iterated on. And with respect to iterative design, it is iterative. So you're going to have to like rewrite your application multiple times to have it working well over the course of its lifetime. It's a ship a thesis thing, where by the time you part ways with the company, the thing you're running doesn't look at all like the thing it was when you started, but it's still technically the same thing somehow. And I'm big on start with serverless, because you're only getting build per request. It's a lot cheaper. You hit a point where you start to have more standard predictable traffic, it makes sense to containerize early. I think you should containerize early and either move into like a container service usually, and eventually not all companies get big enough where they need to migrate to Kubernetes. I know that is like hard for, not everyone likes it when I say that, but it's the truth.
I mean, I think valid critique that Kubernetes gets a lot. Like, we are building stuff for problems that we don't have. You mentioned that. So is, in your opinion, Kubernetes really such a behemoth of complexity? Do you really need it after a certain stage? Or can it play out some of its features in early stage deployments?
I think, just from a cloud spend perspective, what the cost you're going to incur running a Kubernetes cluster and the skill set you need internally to do it well, it can be there are less expensive starting points to pick up. I think it makes, and if you're containerized, migrating to Kubernetes when the time comes isn't that bad. More than the cost side and the complexity, you know, what are the advantages? What capabilities is it providing to an organization? And I think first and foremost, if you have multiple languages in-house, your stack isn't super consistent, you've got some Python, you got some Java or some Golang or some Rust or, you know, TypeScript, whatever, .NET, it's a lot easier to manage that infrastructure with Kubernetes at that point. And you also got service mesh layer capabilities. So can you do canary releases? Can you do blue green deploys? Do you have circuit breakers set up? And I've done blue green deploys with symbolic links and Apache config files, like just with bash. And it's worked. You know, you got to use the tools that are available at the time. But when you're starting to hit global scale traffic and have, you know, follow the sun support, I think it makes sense to be on Kubernetes at that point.
Okay, that's interesting, because you mentioned serverless as a starting point going to like a containerized architecture, containerized landscape within Kubernetes. I sometimes see serverless as kind of the continuation of some things like Kubernetes, because if you have like a landscape of containerized services, there are only so many ways on how to configure like an ingress. There are only so many ways of how to configure like separated network segments and stuff like that. And Kubernetes probably gets a lot of its critique due to the fact that they expose all these details to you, whereas in 80% of the use cases, you would be just fine with saying defaults, which is exactly what serverless provides, because it comes with the promise. It's like, here's my code and please run it for me, right?
It's it can get expensive, is usually what pushes folks out of serverless, that they've just got enough traffic where and sometimes it makes sense to move to a container service, sometimes it makes sense to move to VMs. That's a valid choice. In the past few years, there have been more companies going back to on-prem infrastructure, which isn't what it sounds like. They're paying a service company to run a rack in a colo. They're not going and racking the servers themselves.
Yeah.
If you've got predictable traffic, that's an entirely valid option. The big point with cloud is it's elastic scale that you can scale up and scale down. But if your traffic is constant, then that's not. And that's where serverless makes sense as a starting point, because your initial traffic's assumed to be zero or effectively zero. So it makes it safe to fail. I'm big on safe to fail experimentation, but it puts folks in a position where you can launch an idea with relatively little budget and see if it's got traction before, you know, you're doing cross-region replication with Kubernetes.
That would be.
I don't know why you start there, but I've seen it too many times. that's the first thing we need.
Multi-cloud mesh network of some sort.
It's like you don't have any data. What are you backing up?
Yeah.
It's like, we're going to get there eventually. We'll need it. There'll be a time. I was like, okay, well, it's not today.
Okay, I have a follow-up question, but you are not allowed to answer with it depends. So what would that point be, like, in terms of money? What do you think is, like, as a rule of thumb, a point where it's more cost efficient to run your own Kubernetes cluster than go with, like, serverless function?
When you've got constant traffic, when you've really got constant user traffic, if you're not seeing your serverless service application hit effectively zero, then it's time to spin up something that's more always on and available. And the truth of it is, it doesn't have to be the whole app. So there's a case study, and I'm not going to remember which company it was. I believe it was a bank out of Europe, is specific enough. But they, had pretty robust infrastructure. Most of their clientele was business customers. It was businesses, not personal banking. And especially since they were in Europe, their hours were 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday or something like that.
Yeah.
And after that, their traffic went to pretty much zero over the weekend and in the evenings. They had re-architected their infrastructure where the only thing that got hit was like the bank website and the contact information and like the map to where to find them. That was the stuff that needed to be up 24 hours. So that got migrated to serverless infra because it could spin up on demand. And then the primary business systems, they took them offline and scaled them to pretty much zero outside of normal operating hours. Ended up saving them seven figures a year in cloud spend. So like over $1 million.
Wow.
Which is enough, like plenty to pay me to help with that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, how interesting that they get their contact page on serverless to account for sudden bumps in traffic, because probably they are in a good position if any bank run occurs. Okay. So basically, from what I understand, is your metric on when it's the right time to go from serverless to something that handles predictive load is when the variance of the traffic is low, right? And it's not like the amount of traffic. It's not like if you're spending 10,000 a month on serverless, then you should move. It's more about the variance, right?
Variance within, I would say, week to week, month to month. You've got different variance on a longer time scale. So like over the course of a year or 18 months, and I think that factors into when is it make sense to be in the cloud versus go back to on-prem, or if you need Kubernetes, what kind of dynamic scale you need. We've got Black Friday coming up next week.
Oh, yeah.
In the U.S.
Always a good thing for e-com.
And that is an event where a lot of U.S. retailers, international ones at this point, need to scale dynamically on Black Friday to be able to keep up with demand, but they don't need that infrastructure the rest of the year. So,
yeah, I mean, these are like the textbook examples of why you need it. Like, there's Black Friday, you might run TV ads, something like that.
It was the Super Bowl is another day,
yeah,
where they get pretty much all their traffic from the year that week. And the way that load used to be handled is you had effectively 100% redundant production systems. And you could bring one up, you would have one up most of the year. And then on that, you know, that 1 week, it would be active that both of them were taking traffic. But like super expensive to maintain that. It makes way more sense to pay a cloud provider for that infra and compute.
Totally get it. Like we are talking like the whole conversation is around like distributed systems, right? Microservices, serverless architecture, containers on Kubernetes, replicas, all of that kind of stuff. So if you were to like build an application for let's say a startup from scratch with a small team that fits into one conference room that can potentially be fed by one pizza, like to quote the example from the textbook, would you still go with an architecture like that to prepare for the future, or would you go with something different like a modular monolith or something? Because I feel this is having some kind of revival.
Yeah, it's helpful to start with a more monolithic design because it helps you define a clear perimeter to your application. Mm-hmm. And this is what we're building, and it needs some of this stuff. But like, this is what we're building. If you start with microservices, it's easy to get off your center
in the details.
And Wordly mapping helps with this. It asks where are we going to source a component from, and helps define that perimeter around what you're building. And I am still big on containerization early. Like the earlier you can get in a container, there's a lot of serverless services that will let you ship a container as your artifact, even though you're running on serverless. And has its advantages. You can ship a bigger artifact. I think is usually the main one. So the three platform maps I've been running the past few years is this compute infrastructure, which is, you know, your IAC and just what's going to run your Python code. AI platforms came on the scene a couple years ago, which they're different. So you know you're in an AI platform if you've got LLMs or you're doing GPU compute. And you could even pull that back to like some older school machine learning like algorithms. We're still in the mix. The AI platforms have put back pressure on data platforms. And I think that's where some of the more interesting work is happening right now. And even with a proof of concept app, you know, your pre-launch, just speccing out your idea, you can work on, you know, your app level code all you want. But what kind of data store you're going to use and what your schema looks like, I think is often a harder refactor to do at a minimum. Like it's something that's really where I like to start. Make sure we're making data-driven decisions at an app level.
Yeah. We almost took 30 minutes to come to the point where someone of us mentions AI. We reached it finally.
I was fighting it. I was really
waited until I had to say it. The conversation. Awesome. I think I never made it that far. But anyway, I think there is a reason for that. And the reason is, all that you mentioned was about planning, was about mapping out the actual requirements against what is there, what are the capabilities of the team, what do we really need and whatnot. That is probably something AI won't do. So I'm not sure about you, but I'm not buying into that saying that AI is killing DevOps.
No.
Absolutely not.
No. It's amplifying it, and it's creating new opportunities for automation. The fact that there are AI platforms now and that data platforms need more help to make those work there's an argument that compute platforms are pretty well established at this point, aren't changing that much. And that's fair. You know, the Kubernetes API is pretty hardened. It's not changing a ton. But we're back on, that was the big take out of KubeCon, and it was in Atlanta a couple weeks ago. I was not at the event, but I was around the event. There's a lot of meetups and other gatherings. But the big takeaway for me from what I heard is that they're doing a Kubernetes network certification now. I can't remember the acronym for it. But networking is getting hot again, and part of that is because of we need AI to be able to talk to data in a coherent fashion. MCP gets in the mix. There's some other stuff coming along with that. So there's new work to be done. That's, you know, anytime a certain job starts to wane, there's others with new technologies start to come into focus.
Yeah, we as an industry are very good in finding new problems for stuff that nobody thought about for like years. But true. Yeah, that's also like the way I see it. I mean, AI is tremendously helpful when it comes to ISE or something like that. Like you can write your ideas down and you get your ISE, you get your YAML templates, you get your Pulumi code up and running. That's pretty amazing because all of these APIs are more or less stable nowadays. But you still need to make those decisions. Which data do I take? Do I have like a message queue or not? Kind of these decisions you have to make, and all this like management level stuff that you need to communicate within the organization that AI won't do for you, right?
It's true. That's the theme of DevOps Days Atlanta 2026. We're back in April. Is rebooting, working and living and working in real life. So from that human-centered design, I feel like we're hitting a point where we've got AI agents screaming at each other in the cloud, and that's delivering zero value to humans. And to really break out of that frame and like, what can we like accept as real life? We know it's not a deep fake. You know, what is it doing for people in person in terms of actual value delivery? So that's a complex problem. And I think it's getting, you know, it really pulls into more philosophical thought about, you know, what do people need? What do people want? And what is authentic improvement look like at this point?
Yeah, I saw you already wearing the T-shirt of DevOps Day. Okay, yeah, that's 2022. Okay, but anyway, there will be a new one in 2026, right? In April, right?
Maybe.
You said April. Maybe.
We don't always do T-shirts. We might do T-shirts this year.
Oh, no, I meant the conference. No. Yeah. Yeah. So, but this is fixed, right? A fixed date on April
2026. Yeah, right? April 21st and 22nd. And the current plan is to have our keynotes are going to be Dave Snowden. The creator of the Kinevan framework is a framework for analyzing complex situations. That's like way oversimplified. There's a week long seminar you can give on Kinevan. It's like super neat stuff. And sort of like if I start with the mapping, it eventually expands into the complexity science. But Dave's, you know, been a solid mentor to me over the years. I've learned a lot from him in the framing of what are we doing with AI and how is it impacting humans. He's more into anthrocomplexity, where I'm more into socio-technical complexity. So anthrocomplexity is how humans build tools that shape humans that shape tools over time. Which is really what AI is doing. It's a new set of tools that humans have made that is now influencing society at large. And we need help navigating it. The DevOps community has been researching this stuff for a long time. But, you know, it's helpful if we can get together in person and talk about it, swap notes.
Absolutely. So who is it for? that conference? Who should come there? Because I have some different personas in mind right now. Maybe a fireside chat with the more philosophical guy hanging out over a glass of red wine, talking about how can we improve human life, and maybe another track for suits, sea suits, and another one of geeks nerding around K3S clusters on their Raspberry Pis. What is the audience of that conference?
The party line, and it really comes down to open spaces. Have you done open spaces before?
Yeah.
That's
the idea, basically, of instantaneous topic finding, ideation, and then having
right.
a chat about it.
The crowd, you know, puts post-its up and votes on the topics they want to discuss, and we break out into small groups. That's the second half of both days. And really, I would argue the point of a DevOps days is to have open spaces, but you need talks at the beginning to get sponsors to come in and pay for stuff and to like provide some sort of framing for the open space topics. But the mantra for open spaces is whoever shows up are the right people. And I think that's true of conferences and meetups in general. There's been a lot of talk in the community. We met at Commit Your Code in Dallas at the end of September, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm. I believe it was, yeah.
And there are a lot of community organizers where Commit Your Code. You know, it's really neat what Danny's done with that event over the course of two years.
Big shout out to him.
I'm excited to see where it goes into next year. He's always got a bigger plan. Like the guy really does not stop.
That doesn't stop anywhere, I guess. I mean, what's that going to be in 10 years from now? I don't even imagine.
And that's a long time for an event to be around. Yeah. This will be our 10th DevOps Days Atlanta. But regardless, anybody that's organizing an event, hackathon, could this have been better? I'm like, if you have people showing up, they had like a good time and learned some stuff, met some people, made some friends. You had some level of sponsorship where it didn't come out of anybody's personal budget, and they're interested in coming back again, then congratulations, you had a successful event and should be proud of that. I think there's a requisite variety argument. It's nice to have big conferences like KubeCon where, you know, we've got people in from all over and it sort of takes over the city for a week. I really like smaller local community events like DevOps Days, or they're all over the place. B-Sides Atlanta within the past week or so. And there's probably a DevOps Days and a B-Side security conference around you wherever you are on the planet, which I think is awesome. It's a great way to meet local community.
Yeah, that's awesome. I really think that still, even after the pandemic, like these in-person events are still some kind of undervalued, and people should do them really more often. Because, like, you meet interesting people. We met at such an event. A lot of other people we met, and yeah, I think you should just do it. You should get yourself out there, and it's always amazing. And I like the way you phrased it. Like, the people that show up are the right ones. That's probably not true for any part of life, but in tech it definitely is, at least to my experience.
Yeah, and I thought it was neat when we met, because I realized I knew some local tech communities in your neck of the woods. I'd been DevOps Days started in Ghent in Belgium, which is not too far
right
from where you live.
Corner, yeah.
So it was like this small world of you're at Commit Your Code talking about IAC stuff. I was like, we've got to know some of the same people, but it's...
That's so interesting. I mean, everything is software, as we learned, right? Software is eating the world. But if you look into it, the industry is probably smaller than you think. It's always the same people. I mean, there are circles, there are people that are not showing up publicly. That's fine too. But like the people that you meet, I think there's that seven edges rule, right? You know everybody on the planet, but
seven like, degrees of separation.
7 degrees.
Yeah. The Kevin Bacon.
I think in tech it's probably three.
You've got to get out of your silo, though. I, well, confess to being a tech community tourist. I go hang out with everybody. I go to agile events and security events and design events. The design crowds need to hang out with infrastructure. I front end work. I think it's all fascinating. And from a platform perspective, I see all of those communities as having a seat at the table. They've got some perspective to provide, and there's a user experience to take into consideration there, and it deserves its spot on the map, in my opinion.
Yeah, user experience, business needs, developer experience, not to forget about that. Yeah, absolutely, totally agree on that. Before we go into more philosophical topics, I want to just quickly reiterate over the serverless stuff. That's what I do a lot these days. What's your experience with different platforms, like on different cloud providers in that way? Like AWS has its Lambdas. I think on GCP it's called Cloud Functions, just Cloud Functions, on Azure as well. And now there's a new player, Cloudflare, not a new player at all, but their workers are like gaining more and more popularity. So what's your experience like on a technical level with these things?
I think it gets pulled into the compute conversation quickly. And I think that's entirely valid, but there's room to zoom out on serverless. And remember, it includes things like S3 is technically serverless, CloudFront is serverless. And then that pulls in organizations like Netlify or even GitHub, that you can do a lot on GitHub pages without executing any backend code. Mm. And I think if you've, or being mindful of like how big of an app you're building starting out, there's a lot of opportunities to run from cheap to free and never touch a Lambda function. It's maybe to the point of a fault. Like some of the projects I work on from a personal perspective, I will delay it as long as I possibly can and try to figure out how to not spin up any compute. I think the boldest one I did that worked, I had to build a ticketing system to sell tickets to a theater show. And there was a registration system too. So it was, my kids were homeschooled and we had this homeschool theater thing. So they had to be able to sign up. The students had to sign up for the theater program. And then when they did a play, we handled registration and like payments through Stripe. The class only held like 25, 50 kids. I can't remember, but it was pretty small. And the same thing with the ticket sales. They were just not, you know, maybe we were going to sell 100 tickets. Maybe it wasn't going to be thousands. It's not, you know, Taylor Swift concert or something like that. I ended up not spinning up a database for the whole thing. Stripe's API has a metadata field on it. And I just put everything in there in JSON. So I was not only serverless, I was databaseless. And it worked. Like, it was fine. Like, I wouldn't ship that to a paying customer, but like the opportunity to do it internally. And I'm seeing more of this. So another one I run across that I was skeptical of at first, and I think it has a time and a place, but using Google Docs as a database.
That's a classic. Yeah.
Right. It's kind of the same thing. I mean, that's serverless. You're not signed up for a server.
I did something with GitHub Actions, using issue templates and parsers in Actions to. That was even not only database less. That was even front end less. Things like that's so cool. There's so much to.
I've wanted to play with that. You can drive everything on GitHub with GitHub Actions, and if you're using GitHub Pages. Like, how big of an application can you build that way? And I think it's probably bigger than we're thinking. I think there's a lot of room to move there.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you could add like some mini serverless in terms of like a GitHub app that reacts to webhooks. But even without that, GitHub Actions, a lot of things to discover and play out some creativity and like reducing dependency on like own programming. That's really cool. Yeah.
And this is really what we mean when we talk about emergent complexity from socio-technical systems, that you can release your service and your application into the wild. You never know what the end user is going to do with it. Corey Quinn's got a bit about using Route 53 as a database, which you could totally do. It's not meant for that. And I'm not sure how that builds out, but it's, you could use that as a key value store, sure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I probably would not, like, because in the end, it's DNS. But
it's going to be a problem one way or the other, so you might as well.
Oh, it was DNS. That's actually a good point. So you were like, you did advocate for, okay, probably you should pay a cloud provider doing those things that are just heavy lifting for you if you're a small team, especially. And I think that's valid from that point of view. What do you think about like the resilience of such infrastructures? We've seen, like, it was just last week or something, Cloudflare went down, Regioneer's down. A few weeks before, AWS, US East won. So what's your take on that? Like, this is also like a common point of criticism for those cloud solutions.
It was.
How do you respond?
I think you've got to, we're all in the same boat that we've got to balance the cost of failure with the cost of like what we're willing to invest in resilience. So just like I wouldn't tell a startup that's at square one trying to figure out what their product even looks like, I'm not going to tell them to spin up cross-region. Having done a number of DR implementations, disaster recovery implementations, the two things you've got to set are your RPO, which is your store point objective. So how much data is going to be up post restore, and your RTO, which is your restore time objective, which is how long is it going to take to implement disaster recovery procedures and stand all that up again. And of course, if you ask leadership out of the gate, what do we want available and how quickly do you want it? We want everything. We want it yesterday, right? Like, we need to run always active cross-region, full replication, which would be great if it wasn't super expensive to do that.
You can only pick two.
So if you're going to go bankrupt with your DR plan before you actually run into an incident where you need disaster recovery, that you don't have a viable business anymore. And we often have to approach it from the other direction of, let's say something very bad happened without getting specific on what that is, but we're in a position where we need to do, roll to DR. What do we need for business continuity? What needs to get spun up quickly for us to continue to function, even at a degraded level? But like our primary customers and primary responsibilities, SLAs, et cetera, are going to be met. And hopefully you've got enough budget to cover that. But there are a lot of organizations that don't have a DR plan together. There's a lot of organizations that have spun up DR but aren't doing field exercises to drill that and understand, confirm that RTO and RPO and make sure that things are going to be available and everyone knows how that works. And during an outage, they know how to address it. So, and I think that's really what we're seeing when Cloudflare hiccups or any other major cloud provider, they're falling victim to some of that emergent complexity and just a level of prioritization. But like the conclusion I have to come to is that outage was the most economically viable option that could have happened.
Yeah. Okay.
To a large extent.
That's like from the perspective from you're on a cloud provider and you probably don't need to have a multi-region or failover like in your square one.
It's a question to ask post outage. Like, does it make sense to have been spun up cross region, and would it have avoided this even?
Could you have shunted
traffic and reprovisioned before the outage cleared? It might be quicker to just wait.
But what about the angle, like looking to it, like in a way that is also gaining popularity these days, like just rent out like a dedicated machine and go with something like Kamal or Coolify or something, which is intended to provide like a comparable developer experience like the cloud, but you still run it on your own stuff way more cheap than you could ever run it on AWS or the other cloud provider.
You're arguably at a higher risk for just more local outage. And I think your end users see that regardless if you're in a cloud provider or not, that they're doing construction work, some fiber gets cut, you're going to have some people go offline. And that's one thing. If you lose a segment from a downstream provider, there's not a ton you can do about that. Some of this is out of your control. But if your service is hosted, I don't like root cause analysis. There are always multiple contributing factors. But there can be effectively a single point of failure if you're running in a single colo in one place. And I had the Rackspace outage. Are you familiar with the Rackspace outage?
Not on top of my head right now.
So the story has it. Hopefully I get all this right. Rackspace had a data center out in the middle of nowhere. I can't remember where it was, somewhere in the US. And they had, you know, redundant power into the building, and it was state of the art, just meant designed to never go down. A trucker that lived in the area was driving out to the main highway with a full load in his rig, had a seizure while he's driving the truck. It plows through the chain link fence and the barriers that had been put up around the power infrastructure to keep a car from breaking through it. It's not able to stop a big rig. And then this truck ended up planting between both of the transformers that were for the dual power and didn't take out both of them. From my understanding, they were still online. But when emergency services showed up and realized the guy was still alive, they told Rackspace, more or less, I hope you all have good insurance. Because there's one breathing human being in that truck, and we have to shut this all down to try to save that life. That's like what human factors and safety science boils down to, in my opinion, in a lot of situations. Is that if there are literal lives on the line, those become a priority. And a bad day for Rackspace. I think it hit them pretty hard. But yeah, I agree with the decision. That's why, from an SRA perspective, I prefer post-incident review. I don't like calling it a post-mortem unless there was a death toll, unless there was literally casualties involved. As technologists, we have to be more mindful of that. More frequently, there are lives on the line with the stuff we're working on.
Yeah, that's also true. I mean, if Instagram is out, that might not be a big of a deal, but like if there is a hospital connected to some services or something like that,
I think the
whole story is a bit different.
The big one from the AWS outage was the air conditioned beds stopped working and started malfunctioning. I can't remember what the company's name, but
wasn't that 8Sleep or something?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They were pushing like gigs of data to AWS to air condition your bed somehow, that they needed all this data.
Yeah. So I mean, what a time to be alive. Having a bed that relies on an internet connection is like, it sounds strange to me, but maybe I'm just getting old.
I don't know. Maybe it's like the next sleep breakthrough is somewhere buried in that data. I'm not optimistic, but it could happen.
could happen. So just to recap a little bit about the DevOps day, because I want to give you the opportunity to make some noise around it. So are the CFPs still open?
CFP is open through January, believe it or not.
Okay, how many spots do you have? Like, how many slots for speakers do you have?
So we've got 4 spots for 30-minute talks each day. We've got Dave Snowden and Jules Jim coming in to talk about anthrocomplexity and AI and complexity science, or lack of AI for that matter. Then we've got 5 Ignite talks each day. So 5-minute talk. 20 slides auto advance every 15 seconds, I believe, is how the math works. And we always need more Ignite talks. So I will travel great distances to give a 5-minute talk and hang out at a conference. Most people won't. There's an option on the CFP that you can flag your talk 30 minute or Ignite to give us the option. But last year, we sort of accepted all the Ignite talks to see who showed up. And we had one guy came over from India and gave an Ignite talk in Atlanta. He had some other business to tend to. It was like, had a great time. I think he won an Oculus Rift in the raffle.
Oh, nice.
And we're still in touch on LinkedIn. Like, I think it's like a really neat story. And I'm tempted. I haven't run this by co-organizers. That's why they're there, to keep an eye on me. One of them started it though, last year, with let's just accept all the Ignite talks. I'm wondering how many Ignite talks we can end up flighting each day. I would like to set some kind of Guinness World Record on most Ignite talks at a time.
Oh, that would be amazing. Yeah. what would make a good talk proposal?
Being clear on what you're going to present, being aligned with the themes, And not submitted by AI. I am seeing a lot of talks come in that are obviously AI generated, and I'm tempted to auto reject those. But truth is, it's the hardest part. One of the hardest parts of organizing a conference is we just have to turn down a lot of good proposals. There is like a level of luck involved. We've gotten 300 talks submitted before when we've got, you know, less than 18 slots total. So we end up telling a lot of people no. I think you could flight multiple successful events off of a single CFP. But we can't accept your talk unless you turn one in, is what I always tell people. Can't guarantee it's going to get through, but there's not a chance if you don't turn it in. So
where do people sign up?
If you go to devopsdays.org/Atlanta, that's the event website. There's a link to the CFP there. It's also hosted on Sessionize, so you can find it just straight on Sessionize also. Yeah. And we're also looking for sponsors. We've got some inquiries in so far. Thank you to our 2025 sponsors. Honeycomb was in for platinum, but we can't make the event happen if we don't have support from sponsors.
Yeah, very cool. So like sponsors or attendees or potential speakers, they could all reach out to you also. Like you are active on X or Twitter, as we call it.
Yep.
And LinkedIn, I guess.
I'm Ecology Chris.
To reach out?
I'm Ecology Chris on most social media. All that's available if you go to contact on the website. My information's there along with a lot of my co-organizers. You might know some of them already. And we're pulling in more people too to help out with this year. So it's a big network in Atlanta. If you know folks from Atlanta, there's a chance we're acquainted. So, you know, reach out through your network. And by all means, check and see if you got a DevOps Days or a B-Sides. Or something close to home too. I think that's a good leading indicator. know, I'm big on plant a garden where you're standing, work in your local community, but it's good to like get some cross-pollinization in and visit a new place and meet some new people too. So
absolutely, I love that.
Are you going to submit a talk?
Well, maybe, I'm tempted. But yeah, I mean, it's a long way for me, but maybe. Now you put the pressure on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll keep my eyes peeled, see if we get one in.
Okay, cool. Yeah, or maybe we see some at some DevOps day around my place here.
Yeah, there's always stuff going on around Ghent, I know. Yeah. So I mean, I'll be able to make it back soon.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, always nice to visit.
That was a nice conversation. We touched a lot of topics. I hope we got like some kind of red line flowing through that. But I think we did a good job. What do you think?
Yeah, it felt good to me. Felt clean.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time. It was good.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. We'll talk soon.
Talk soon.